Good evening, and welcome to Health Matters. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz, and I'll be your host this evening. An estimated 1.6 million people were diagnosed with cancer in 2016. Cancer researchers are continuously making breakthroughs that lead to improved technology and medical treatments for this dreaded disease. When diagnosed with cancer, it's important to know your treatment options. In this Health Matters, we will be discussing some of the latest cancer treatments available in our area. I am joined here tonight in the studio by Dr. Jake Wong, radiation oncologist, and Dr. Tyler Lash, medical oncologist, both physicians at the Willis Knighton Cancer Center in Shreveport. Health Matters is a live show, and we invite you to join our discussion. We will take your questions and comments at 1-800-552-8502 or via Twitter at RRR Public Radio. Well, I want to welcome my guests, Dr. Wong and Dr. Lash. They are experts in the field of cancer treatment. We're very fortunate to have them here this evening. When we take calls, however, I would like to remind our listeners that they cannot diagnose or make treatment recommendations via this format. So this is not a substitute for a medical consultation, a formal medical consultation with a medical professional. So to get started, Dr. Lash, tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and about your training and what it means. How does someone become a medical oncologist?
Well, first off, thanks for letting me be on the show. And so I'm actually from Shreveport, Louisiana. Went to Byrd High School and then college at Louisiana Tech Medical School back in Shreveport at LSU. And then I did my residency training at UAB in Birmingham and then fellowship training at Wake Forest. So I guess to become a medical oncologist takes a lot of time.
That's a lot of years.
Lots of school, lots of training.
Yeah.
Some people say that that I'm dedicated, but maybe it's more of just delaying growing up.
I'm sure you're plenty dedicated. Dr. Wong, how about yourself?
Thank you for having me here. Well, I received my clinical training in radiation oncology from UT Southwestern in Dallas. But before medical school, I was also kind of delaying growing up. I actually pursued a PhD in bioengineering from UCLA, focusing on molecular biology and tissue engineering. I grew up in Taiwan, and I came to the U.S. after college and basically stayed in the West Coast and then East Coast in Texas, and now I'm here to help serving the patients.
So you're well-traveled. So if I understand you, a medical career is basically the result of arrested development.
Yes.
You can say that, yes.
Well, that's actually ties into what we're going to talk about tonight, because I guess oncology is the practice of medicine which tries to arrest tumor cell growth. So with that, let's discuss exactly what is cancer, Dr. Lash.
I think cancer is probably best described as just unchecked cell proliferation.
Proliferation meaning?
Growth.
Growth.
Mm-hmm. So usually your body is able to recognize cells that are growing abnormally, but sometimes for whatever reason, they escape that. And when you have cells that are growing unchecked and just grow out of control, you end up with cancer.
So why would they grow out of control and unchecked? What happens?
It's probably multifactorial is the term that most people say, having to do with genetic issues, whether people have a genetic predisposition in their DNA, or exposure to environmental factors. Cigarette smoking is the first that comes to mind, all the way to when they do twin studies, something called epigenetics, which also supports environmental factors, other than just the things we know about of smoking and drinking.
So in other words, people who have the same genes might be exposed to different
environmental
cancer causes,
triggers.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that could translate into a cancer. So if I understand what you're saying, basically the cells have a tightly controlled mechanism that governs whether they divide or grow, and something kind of goes haywire in that process, and then it becomes unchecked.
Exactly.
And then that Okay.
And so, just to add a little bit of Dr. Lash might be able to elaborate a little bit more, but a lot of times we have a kind of abnormal cell dividing every day, but a lot of times our immune system are able to come in to clean it up, but somehow some of the process, during this process, some cells are able to escape the immune mechanisms, and at some point they're also able to develop a way to escape and growing outside their normal environment that they're going to other organs that are causing the metastasis. We call that metastasis. And these is very multiple different steps in process, and both the radiation as well as the chemotherapy try to explore these different steps and try to kind of enhance the body to fight off cancer.
That's excellent. Mm-hmm. I see. So there's actually maybe a faulty immune response that's part of the issue is what you're saying. So, Dr. Lash, you mentioned carcinogens or cancer-causing substances. So how exactly do they cause cancer? How do they affect the cells that make them cancerous?
Probably the most common way that people think of is damage to DNA, whether it's through oxidation or just local inflammation, high cell turnover. The more times you have cells turn over, the more times a cell has to, I guess, copy its DNA incorrectly.
Why you typically see cancers in older adults as opposed to younger adults?
I think so. I had an attending that used to say, you know, if somebody lives long enough, they're going to develop some form of MDS, which is a form of bone cancer. And it's just they have years and years and years of cell division. It increases their chances of one of those cells to divide incorrectly, the DNA to be copied incorrectly, and then you develop a cancer cell.
So based upon what I hear you saying, it sounds as though perhaps cancer is an inevitable condition resulting from, I guess, an imperfect biology that ultimately will develop if people live long enough. So it sounds like it's not a disease in some of the other in how we think about like infectious disease. It seems a little bit different in terms of being like an inborn condition.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So then, why do some people who, let's say, smoke or exposed to other cancer-causing substances, why would some people get cancer and not others?
I'd say those are probably lucky people. But I would say that goes back to the multifactorial comment about where cancer comes from, is that it you probably have to have a genetic predisposition to it combined with the exposure to carcinogens and cigarettes or other environmental factors that we aren't necessarily aware of, and together creates cancer.
I see, which is why I guess family history is important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. And Dr. Wong, are there different types of cancer, or cancer's just basically one disease?
Well, cancer is it's kind of like a generic term, and cancer can be derived from any cells in our body. It depends on where they initially come from. So if it's a cancer initially derived from the lung, it's a lung cancer. If it's derived from a breast, it's a breast cancer. If it's derived from the brain, it's a brain cancer. So it really depends on where the tumor initially cells come from, where they become like a wire. Then there's the cancers. They all are alike in a way, as Dr. Lash was mentioning, their regulation mechanism is kind of out of whack, and they only know how to divide, and as they divide, they kind of uptake all the resources and kind of limiting the normal body's function.
I see. So our listeners are very welcome to call in with a question for our panel. The number again is 1-800-552-8502. And if you would like to know something about cancer in general or perhaps a specific type of treatment, please call in. So when you talk about these different types of cancer, how exactly is stage important? What does it mean to have a particular stage? Stage 1, stage 4. What exactly does that mean?
So that's a good question, and that's often the question the patient asks us. The first question patient asks us. So I think there's a couple of things we need to know about staging. The first is that I think the purpose of the staging, one is to give us the prognosis of the disease, and the other important thing about staging is that the physicians are able to use the staging to to communicate with each other to figure out how comparing one patient to the to another. So generally, when we look at the staging, the American Journal of AJCC is kind of the organization come up with the staging system. We look at the size of the tumor, the degree of the how much invasion to the other structures, as well as the how the tumor has spread to the regional lymph nodes, as well as to distant metastasis. And in all these information, we kind of gather and divide it in general term from stage one to stage four. Basically, the lower the number, stage one meaning that the tumor is still localized, you know, or limited in a specific area or initial organ. When we say stage four, generally the idea is that the tumor has already spread outside the initial organs, then it become a metastatic disease. So it's a way for us to kind of describing the stage of the condition, as well giving the prognosis, as well communicating with other people.
I see. Now, you mentioned nodes, lymph nodes.
Yes.
What exactly are lymph nodes, and how do they fit into cancer spread?
So lymphatic systems are basically where our immune cells in our body lives, and they kind of clear up infections and doing other kind of the structure in the body. And when cancer start to spread, the lymph nodes are usually the first area that the tumor goes to. And different organs have different, we call the lymphatic drainage. That means that the least where the tumor goes to the first places. And when we say it's going to metastasize to the lymph nodes, we still consider it as a regional kind of disease, and we can still treat it with a kind of local regional treatments. But once it's spread to the lymph nodes, there's a higher risk of spreading outside the regional regions, and that become a distant metastasis.
I see. Now, when we think of cancer treatment, we generally think of surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. We don't have a surgeon with us this evening, although in general, I think, would you say it's fair to say that surgery is useful, particularly in early stage disease, when disease is caught, you know, where it's can be removed mostly. That's right.
Yes.
The majority of the cancer mm-hmm. could be removed.
Would yes, you agree? I agree.
Okay. Yeah. So that leaves us with chemotherapy and radiation. Now, Dr. Lash, you treat patients with chemotherapy. Can you tell our listeners what is chemotherapy?
So I think chemotherapy nowadays is a term that's used to encompass a very broad variety of treatments. I think, and we use that term, but it means something to doctors and it means something else to patients. So when I say systemic therapy or chemotherapy, I'm thinking of classical chemotherapy, cytotoxic chemotherapy that most pops into most people's mind. But I'm also thinking about other types of systemic therapy, including immunotherapy, targeted therapy, a wide variety of different treatments. But whenever I think most of the public thinks of chemotherapy, they think of the classical cytotoxic chemotherapy that is known for being oftentimes difficult to take, making you feel bad. And so I think that it's important whenever you have discussions to nowadays, since there's so many drugs, so many different types of treatment, that we need to be better about being specific of what we're talking about.
And not all chemotherapy is the same.
No.
So mm-mm. the chemotherapy given for lung cancer might be different than what was given, say, for brain cancer, than for colon cancer. And so I think that sometimes folks say, oh, I remember my uncle had chemotherapy 15 years ago for lung cancer, and they'd be, you know, they've got a diagnosis of, let's say, breast cancer, but yet they might have the perception that it's going to be like what that person got.
Correct.
15 years
mm-hmm.
ago. So what you're saying is things are different, and that there's a much larger armamentarium of agents that you now use. So the term chemotherapy is kind of a broad mm-hmm. broad term.
Yeah, so when someone says chemotherapy, you should ask them to clarify.
Okay, so. Very good. Well, I want to move further into that topic and then talk about radiation, but we've got our first caller, so we definitely want to get our caller on. Now, I believe the name is Hill. And I don't know if that's a man or a woman. So let's find out. Is it a Mr. Hill or a okay, Hill for Manny. Welcome to Health Matters.
Is there anything to the notion that diet, either things you should include or things you should exclude, that plays into the cancer propensity one way or the other? I've heard various people say this, don't eat this or eat that sort of thing. Is there anything, do these doctors know anything about diet impact whatsoever?
I will say that that's probably one of the most frequently asked questions that I get in the office. And probably the way I would look at diet is in two separate settings. One is in the patient who does not have cancer, and one in the patient who does have cancer. So in the first scenario, the patient who does not have cancer, there is a lot of data out there that shows that diet does affect your risk of developing cancer. And certainly having a healthy diet along with exercises decreases a person's risk of cancer. And then for the second scenario, the person who has developed cancer, you know, people who have just heard that news, it's a big shock to their life, and they're very interested in doing whatever they can to get better, to get rid of the cancer. And one of those, you know, aspects is treatment, which is something that I do, and that's kind of, you know, out of their hands because they can't necessarily control that. But something that is in their hands is their diet, and that's something that they go home and they do and they take care of, and they want to know, you know, what can I do with my diet now that I have cancer, you know, to make it better. And you know, I always tell patients, I wish that there was a diet I could tell them that I think would make a significant impact on the treatment of their cancer. But what I tell them I think is most important about their diet is that they maintain a healthy diet so that they can be physically strong enough to receive whatever treatment is recommended. So I think that you have to look at it in two different scenarios. And for sure, for the person who is does not have a diagnosis of cancer, you know, you want to do everything to prevent that. You know, the best medicine is preventative medicine. So I would just encourage everyone to follow, you know, a reasonable, healthy diet.
Diet is not urban legend, then. It may have some impact.
I think it has some impact.
But now, that's an excellent question. And as a follow-up to your question, Hill, is, you know, people sometimes are interested in following specific anti-cancer diets, like either the no-sugar diet or the alkali diet or some of these other diets. Dr. Lash, can you speak to that a little bit?
I mean, I had someone today asking me, you know, if they should follow a plant-based diet. So, I mean, that definitely is out there. I would say it's hard to say exactly how much benefit it does have on the person who already has cancer. The thing that I worry the most about is when you include supplements into that, because some supplements are known to interact with drugs. You know, just because it comes from nature doesn't mean that it's not a drug itself. So usually I just counsel people to have, you know, a balanced diet. You know, as far as the strict plant-based diet or the low sugar diet, you know, I'm not aware of anything that's just definitively shown, you know, a significant benefit in treating cancer.
Hill, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
We're going to move on to Randall from Cross Lake. Randall, welcome to Health Matters.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to follow up on the last listener's question, and then I had a second question as well. I think it was the World Health Organization recently suggested that red meat in particular raised the risk for cancer. I was wondering if you guys had recommendations for what types of red meat people should avoid if they have a family history of cancer, if there are any red meats that are better than others, like from the standpoint of lean versus, you know, more fatty red meats. And then the second question I had was, is vaping associated with lung cancer the same way that smoking is? And I'll listen to the answers on the air. Thank you so much for having the program on cancer tonight.
I definitely have heard about data that supports that, you know, in having red meat in your diet predisposes you to cancer. Also, eating a lot of smoked meat, grilled meat, or charred meat can increase your risk of cancer. And, you know, I think that, it's a very reasonable, likely thing. But as far as, you know, putting a quantity on how much should I, how much should I not, I think it's real hard to say, because you have to realize that all of these studies are, you know, population-based retrospective studies. You know, it's kind of looking back and, you know, asking people, I guess, how much red meat do you eat? It's not like it's a randomized trial where they have this group of people that eats this amount and this group of people that doesn't. So I think, you know, a good rule of thumb is just in moderation. You know that statistics show that there is a risk for it, and also more on the, you know, cardiovascular risk side, it's probably best not to eat a lot of fat. There's a lot of data that, you know, certain areas of the world that are heavy on a fish diet as opposed to a red meat diet have better cardiovascular health than, you know, probably Americans do.
What about the vaping?
And so as far as the vaping, that's such a new thing. Last time I looked at anything about that, I think it was, the comment was, there's not enough long-term data for it. So I'm not sure about vaping.
Yeah, I completely agree with what Dr. Dash was saying. I do agree that for diet, it's a well-balanced diet is more important than like having focus on the quantity itself or specific type of diet. And also, I want to echo that during both the chemotherapy as well as radiation, it's important to talk to your doctor about the supplements that you're taking. For example, during the radiation, we generally don't want people to be a very super high dose or mega dose of the vitamins, because there are some ideas that they generate counteract with the effect of radiation. Similar thing as for chemotherapy as well. So that's definitely a good thing to talk with your doctor about all these.
Thank you very much for your call, Randall. So Dr. Wong, we learned a little bit about chemotherapy, and I understand there's different types. What exactly is radiation therapy?
So radiation therapy, often people are somehow a little bit more scared of it. But I want to point out that radiation therapy actually a very important part of the cancer care. I would say probably about 60% of the cancer patients will receive some form of radiation during their course of treatment. Radiation can be curative intent. That is, we're trying to get rid of the tumor forever or the cancer forever. Or for those patients that unfortunately cannot be cured, radiation can often offer as a palliative intent, that is trying to reduce the pain or reducing the symptoms or improve as well as improving patient quality of life. So it's really kind of the crucial part of the cancer treatment that can be delivered either together with the chemotherapy or in adjunct with the surgery as well.
So Dr. Lash was saying how there are different types of chemotherapy or systemic therapy. Are there different types of radiation therapy?
Yes, there's definitely different type of radiation therapy. But to back it up a little bit, basically how a lot of people come in asking, how does radiation work to damage the cells? And I basically I often tell the patient that radiation how radiation works is by damaging the cell's DNA. And DNA are the genetic material that control the cell's mechanisms, the functions, and all basically how the cells everything. And so radiation damages the cell's DNA. And for normal cells, when the DNA get damaged, the cells try to repair and stop and hold the division. However, for cancer cells, as Dr. Lash was previously mentioning, cancer cells are very good or only knows how to divide and kind of proliferate very fast. And in this case, the cancer cells don't have a very good repairing mechanisms. So when they try to divide, these damage get accumulated. And when this damage accumulate too much, the cells cannot divide anymore and they die off. We call it mitotic catastrophe. And and for radiation, we kind of exploit these differential DNA repair mechanisms and kind of treating the cancers. And getting back to their different type of radiation, we can think of it as delivering with a different type of radiation types, that is either photon or X-rays versus like particles such as proton radiation. There are also different techniques to deliver radiation that include external beam radiation as well as internal or brachytherapy radiation. So those are the things we can go into a little bit details.
So how does someone know whether they need radiation or chemotherapy? How do the doctors know what to treat in terms of each situation? Is it something that's variable or a matter of opinion, or are there established guidelines? Dr. Lash?
Thankfully, there are established guidelines and algorithms to follow, just because medicine is growing so fast and there's so many different treatment options. It's hard to keep up with it. But, thanks to, the internet and things like UpToDate, NCCN guidelines, information is readily available. And so for the most part, in my practice and probably most oncologists' practice, I use NCCN guidelines kind of as a foundation for what I do.
What does that stand for, NCCN?
It stands for the National... Comprehensive Cancer Network. I'm just so used to saying NCCN, but I think it's kind of the gold standard of how we come up with what we do, and so regularly, periodically, leaders in cancer research meet together and they go through just enormous amounts of literature and they come up with what is the best thing or best path to follow according to the stage, as Dr. Wong was talking about earlier, and cancer type, to get the best outcome just based off of statistics. And so you take your statistical data of how this, particular person would be expected to behave in general, but then you try to personalize it for them. So that's why I say I use NCCN as kind of the foundation of my thought process, and then I take the individual to try to personalize it more.
So that's the basis by which you know whether to give chemotherapy, what type of chemotherapy, radiation, both together, one before the other, surgery incorporated. So it just kind of gives mm-hmm. you a framework yep. from which to work, and then personalize it to the individual. Is that what you're saying?
Yep.
And a lot of times, these guidelines are, I mean, medicine is a constantly evolving fields. And these guidelines are basically evolved from a lot of time, like randomized studies, that we have patients involving on the clinical trials that we randomized to control, which is the standard of care, versus newer treatments, and then they're comparing the outcomes. And when the randomized trials is not available, which is often a lot of times, they also have a kind of a population studies or other type of studies, to retrospective studies or population studies, to looking at the outcomes. And then these national specialists all get together and come up with the consensus guidelines. There are also national organizations, both in all different specialties, including the medical oncologists or radiation oncologists. They all kind of coming together and looking to the best evidence and making recommendations.
So it sounds like if there are established guidelines that are, for the most part, universally followed by most oncologists, then presumably you would get pretty much the same care regardless of where you lived. Is that fair to say? As opposed to, because I know a lot of times people think, well, I need to leave town to get appropriate care. Is that necessarily the case, or in what circumstances would someone need to seek out, let's say, what we call a tertiary care facility or a major cancer center, a regional or national cancer center, versus, let's say, a regional cancer center like what we have here in Shreveport, or what they have in some of the other communities in our listening audience?
I think for more standard or more common cancers, you'd for the most part get the same treatment no matter where you were, assuming that whatever oncologist you were seeing stayed up to date with literature and followed these guidelines that we're talking about. But I would say if someone has a very rare cancer or presentation of a cancer where there's not much data for it, then in those situations, it is good to go to the larger centers, to places that would have high volume and have experience with those scenarios. And it very well may be that just you need a clinical trial, because we don't know what to do for that. And so at least by a clinical trial, we would, you know, hopefully one day know what to do in that situation.
I also want to point out that I think everyone should also consider the importance of the support systems that will be closer to home. I think cancer care is often not just the medical treatment itself, but also the social support and the family support is also a very important part of the cancer care. And there's advantage being staying closer to home, and that's a very important part of cancer care. So I would actually recommend people talk to the local doctors first and really find out what can be offered in the local regional area. And a lot of time when you realize that the local regional places can offer the same or even better kind of treatment comparing going to travel to the tertiary or faraway places. And that's just something that will save you a lot of trouble going to faraway places and receiving the same or even not as better care comparing to staying home.
I see. Well, we have another caller I want to get to. This is Clyde from Natchitoches. Clyde, welcome to Health Matters.
Natchitoches.
Oh, I'm sorry. I always get those two confused.
Well, they're the same word except heard by Spanish and French.
And so Natchitoches is in Texas and Natchitoches is in Louisiana.
That's right. We're 100 miles apart, something like that.
Okay. Well, welcome either way, Natchitoches. Welcome both. We welcome both callers from either place, but you're on the line, so we would love to hear what your question is.
Okay. Well, my wife was, a little while ago, diagnosed with something called cutaneous B-cell lymphoma. And what can you tell us about that? And I'll just go ahead and shut it down and let you talk, okay?
Thank you very much for your call, Clyde.
Uh-huh.
Well, I could tell you the first thing that, you know, that's rare. When I think of cutaneous lymphomas, the first thing that pops in my mind is a cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. But if this was a cutaneous B-cell lymphoma, I would say that that's rare. And, you know, what we talked about earlier of, you know, when is it a good time to go to an academic center? You know, that would, you know, be a good time to go to an academic center. And if somebody walked into my office and had a cutaneous B-cell lymphoma, that's probably what I would do is find someone who has seen a lot more of those than me, because I haven't seen any, and we would get their opinion and see if that's something that we could treat, you know, at home, as Dr. Wong was saying, so you could be around your support system.
No, actually, in what we were saying before, we are very fortunate here in town to have an expert in lymphomas and leukemias who's got all sorts of training and very, very experienced. So in fact, we, you know, again, even for rare tumors, you may not need to go elsewhere. But yes, there are definitely tumors that require specialists. So we, you know, in a bigger town, you do have people who specialize in different forms of cancer. And we have a medical school here in town. So in speaking to Dr. Lash, definitely it is, you know, sometimes we encounter some very rare tumors. So I want to get back to the targeted issue. Dr. Lash, we're going to, I guess you hear a lot about targeted systemic therapies. You don't hear as much about targeted radiation therapies, although I believe that there are some. And Dr. Wong, could you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I think one of the most important advances in radiation is how accurately or precisely we can deliver radiation comparing to 20, 30 years ago. And there are different advances, including the image guidance radiation or as well as stereotactic radiation therapy. There's also different, we can deliver precise radiation to all these areas. In a way, radiation is all focal and target. It's just like how accurate and precise we can deliver. Yeah.
So what are the different techniques of doing targeted radiation? What are there some special terms?
So, for example, you might hear the stereotactic radiation therapy. So that's a way we use, first of all, as a kind of a in the head, treating the brain, the lesions in the brain metastasis. So old days, previously, so when people have developed brain metastasis, they have to treat with the whole brain. That is treating all the brain through and through. But then as the advancing in medical oncology and more medicine, systemic therapy, people are live longer, and with a better imaging techniques, we caught these kind of metastasis early. So there we found out that there are some patients that have a kind of limited brain metastasis. So people start thinking that, well, if we can deliver those focused radiation to only the side that we see in the brain, and that's when people start developing techniques. One of the techniques is called the stereotactic radiosurgery. And in the old days, what people do is they use like a cobalt 60 and put like a drill like holes in your skull and put a frame on your head.
So that's basically radiation sources.
Yes, cobalt 60 is radiation sources, and they drill holes and you put a frame on your head to stabilize you on the table. And but these days there's so much advancing technology. We have the frameless system, for example, that we don't need to drill holes on your head, and also the machine technology, we can deliver radiation and monitor the motion really closely and precisely, and really using a less invasive term to deliver radiations.
Now, can you do that in other parts of the body, not just the brain?
Yes, definitely. As I said, start with delivering to the brain, but then people also use a similar kind of concept to kind of extend it to outside the body. You may hear like a stereotactic body radiation therapy or stereotactic ablative radiation therapy as SBRT or SABR, S-A-B-R.
Yeah. So if it's focused and targeted, does that mean that the side effects are less?
Yes, definitely. That's the goal, because we can deliver the high dose radiation to a very focal area while really have minimum dose or kind of like a very low dose to the surrounding structures. That really minimizes the side effect both acutely and long-term wise.
Okay, so that's targeted radiation. I want to give the number again for callers to call and ask a question. That's 1-800-552-8502. So, Dr. Lash, let's talk a little bit about targeted systemic therapy. I guess historically people think about chemotherapy being non-selective and it attacking some of the good cells, and then there being side effects. How are the targeted therapies different?
Mm-hmm. So even, like I said earlier, you have to be careful saying chemotherapy and clarify by what you mean by that. Almost even when you say targeted therapy, you got to clarify what you mean by targeted therapy, because, now there's targeted therapy that like tyrosine kinase inhibitors that target specific cell mechanisms involved in cell activity and proliferation. There's targeted therapy that just targets cell surface antigens or specific proteins on a cell that will allow it to attack it. And then there's targeted therapy that blocks certain receptors on cells that prevents it from binding to certain chemicals that allow it to grow. And then there's targeted therapy in the immunotherapy world. So there's so many different types of targeted therapy that you also have to be specific with that term as well.
So, okay. So if I understand you correctly, it's a very complex system, mm-hmm. in terms of the mechanism by which tumors grow and mm-hmm. are stimulated to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe like a big factory. And so what you're saying is these targeted therapies differ in terms of at what point they foul up the works of the tumor cell's ability to grow. So mm-hmm. there's lots of different ways of mm-hmm. targeting the tumor cell growth to disrupt it and kill it. Is mm-hmm. that basically what you're saying?
Yep.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So in general terms, since I know it gets rather involved and there's a lot of biology and chemistry and whatnot, what are the advantages of these targeted systemic therapies?
Well, the advantage is similar to what Dr. Wong was talking about with more focused radiation, is that if you have more focused targets, hopefully you'll have less toxicity. So as opposed to classical cytotoxic chemotherapy that affects every dividing cell it touches, you're hoping that with this targeted therapy, it only affects cells with the specific target on it. So the more targeted that drug is to the specific cells of concern, the less side effects you will have in the normal healthy cells.
How well do they work?
They work really well, oftentimes better than the cytotoxic chemotherapy.
And how do you know when to use them?
You start with the NCCN algorithm.
Back to the Now, are there any tests that can be performed to predict whether or not some of those targeted therapies are likely to be more effective than others?
Yes. Probably the one that's most exciting and becoming most familiar to the patient and people just at home, thanks to TV and commercials, is immunotherapy. Commercials for Opdivo and Keytruda are probably the most well known. And so there's tests that you can do that will give us an idea of how responsive our immunotherapy will be in those tumors. Also, one that's been around for longer, like for instance breast cancer, there's tests that you can do on the tumor cells that will give us an idea of if we can use hormonal drugs to control it.
So are the targeted therapies necessarily given first? Are they given after other types of chemotherapy, or is it kind of depend on the situation?
It depends on the situation and what particular algorithm you're looking at. Many of them are first line. Some of them you may have to get to a second line to use. Mm-hmm. A couple of them you even have to go through a couple lines to get to.
I see. And how has that affected the cure rates of some of these cancers? Has it improved it considerably?
It's still up for debate in the immunotherapy world. There are some very malignant, incurable diseases in the past that have patients that have been on studies that are still in durable remissions that leave us wondering if some of those patients have been cured. For example, metastatic melanoma. Some people in those studies are in durable remissions, and you wonder, you know, at what point, how many years out does somebody have to be to say that they're cured? And then on the other hand, you have things like CML, which is a blood cancer that years ago had a very bad prognosis, and then they came out with a targeted therapy called imatinib that's a pill that you take, and you take it every day. Most patients with CML end up having normal lifespans, and so they still have the drug. I mean, they still have the cancer, but as long as they take that drug, it's under control. So it becomes more of like a chronic illness like hypertension. So, you know, that person, majority of those people don't die of that cancer. So would you say they're cured of it? You know,
or managed.
Or managed. It's just kind of changing how, you know, you perceive.
So would everyone with CML then benefit from that medication?
Not everybody. There are those that, you know, unfortunately do not benefit.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And is there a way to predict that ahead of time?
You can check labs for various mutations. So some mutations may not respond to one particular pill that will respond to another. And so you have some patients that unfortunately don't respond initially, and then you have a backup that will work.
It sounds like treatment has gotten very personalized.
It is.
which is really remarkable. Mm-hmm. Dr. Wong, getting back to the targeted types of radiation, you mentioned something called brachytherapy, which I guess is putting radioactive sources in tumors. But there's some other types of targeted treatments, let's say, in the liver, whereby you can give radiation to the liver, either with or without chemotherapy.
I think you probably are thinking about one of the new technology called the CERT, basically using an yttrium one of the radioactive source.
Radioactive source.
Source that we call the radioembolization, basically. So we use a material called yttrium-90, which is a beta emitter that kind of linked to a glass or resin residue, the microspheres. And then it's interesting about liver is that the liver has that different blood supplies, the hepatic artery and the portal systems. And tumors mainly getting the blood supply from the hepatic arteries. And so we use that differential kind of blood supply systems and input these kind of radioembolized materials into the liver tumors. And that can relatively selectively treating the liver tumors, including primary liver tumors, as well as liver metastasis, that's the tumors that gone into the liver.
I see. Now, this all sounds very high-tech. And presumably must be very expensive. Are the targeted medicines, the systemic therapies, Dr. Lasher, are they generally covered by health insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, and are they easily to obtain, or what has been your experience?
They are definitely expensive. Whenever they fall, you know, as first line standard of care, second line standard of care, they will get covered to some extent by most insurances. And you can get them. It's not always the easiest process of getting them. Sometimes it has to do with, you know, being involved with the insurance companies and being involved with the drug companies. So, you know, maybe some deal, well, you find out how much the insurance company will cover, and then you let the drug company know what's left over, and then oftentimes they'll make you a deal so that the medication's affordable. Many of them are definitely, you know, covered by insurance, lots of insurances, but sometimes it does take a little bit extra effort to get them. But usually you can always get them.
Okay. And so what are some of the types of cancers that you would typically or commonly treat with targeted therapy?
The lymphomas are very commonly incorporate targeted therapy into them. I would say, you know, if you count immunotherapy as a targeted therapy, which I would, it's spread to almost all of the very common solid tumors, from melanoma to lung cancer to kidney cancer to colon cancer. And there's now data for breast cancer, so I imagine that pretty soon it will be a part of neoadjuvant therapy for breast cancer. So it's just kind of spreading everywhere.
I tell you what I'll do. So I'm going to name a body site that can get cancer. And Dr. Lash, you tell me whether there's targeted therapy, systemic therapy available for it. And Dr. Wong, you do the same from a radiation standpoint, okay? Mm-hmm. All right, let's start up. Brain. Targeted therapy or not?
There's definitely targeted radiation for the brain. As I previously mentioned, both stereotactic radiosurgery as well as a focused radiation. That's a very focal radiation therapy.
Okay, Dr. Lash?
Yeah, primary brain cancer, assuming it's not coming from another site, most commonly is still chemotherapy.
Okay, what about if it recurs? Is there any second line? Is there any targeted therapy?
I believe my understanding that Dr. Lash may be able to elaborate a little bit more, but I think the Avastin, the VEGF kind of inhibitor, yeah, can be used as a second line. Mm-hmm. On the other kind of perspective, there's also newer kind of device, we call the tumor treatment field device, that is actually applying electric fields to basically focusing on the tumor areas and how. Because they would call that when the cell divide, the mitotic process, it's kind of like the DNA, the chromosomes align on a plane, and kind of the spindles cells that pull the spindles apart. And when you apply the electric fields, they somehow can put the mitotic activity under arrest, and that kind of can can reduce the tumor division, and that has been shown actually in both in the recurrent glioblastoma setting, which is a primary brain tumors, as well as the recurrent kind of setting, and that improved the survival in these patients.
So this is different than the magnets that you get like to put inside your shoes.
Yeah, yeah, they use intermediate frequency kind of electric fields and prohibiting the cells divisions.
Yeah. Got it. Okay, let's move down from the brain. Head and neck cancers, Dr. Lash?
Targeted?
Okay, mm-hmm. We got targeted. And what about radiation targeted?
So we have radiation in the head and neck cancer is becoming very very sophisticated. In a way, we have proton therapy. We haven't get a chance to mention that can be applied in the head and neck regions or in at least part of the treatment areas, and that can be a targeted agent therapy. And the IMRT the audience may hear about. It's also kind of using different kind of radiation beams to really limiting the dose to the normal structures while focusing the higher dose to the surrounding area. So it's a little bit different from the prior stereotactic radiation that we mentioned, but in a way it's also kind of differential doses to different structures in the head and neck that to the different levels of the kind of the region in head and neck we can deliver.
Okay, great. And I'm going to take a stab at immunotherapy for head and neck cancer, but from the preventative standpoint for the HPV virus. Can you say a little bit about that, Dr. Lash?
I know that there is effort to separate HPV positive and HPV negative disease into two separate categories. But
in terms of the vaccine, preventative.
Oh, yes. Vaccine is definitely preventative.
Preventative. Okay, so that's immuno. So that's we're going to call that targeted. How about skin, Dr. Wang? Is targeted radiation for skin cancer or no?
So I couldn't specifically think of, but then there are different ways to deliver radiation therapy, including like superficial radiation therapy, or for some cases, some of the limited skin issues that there are brachytherapy for some specific limited skin diseases.
I'm going to give that an intermediary.
I have a question. So would you kind of consider PUVA therapy radiation?
Ooh, for ultraviolet light.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not targeted though, right? It's kind of more diffuse.
But if it's a cutaneous lymphoma.
Okay, we're going to give that a yes, but what about systemic therapies?
Yes. Melanoma is kind of where all the immunotherapy got the boost from with the checkpoint inhibitors, the Opdivo and Keytruda or ipilimumab.
How about basal cell carcinomas?
Yes.
Okay. Thyroid cancer.
With nuclear medicine, the radioactive iodine therapy.
Yeah,
yes.
I agree. That's a radioactive iodine. That's I-131 will be here.
So that is targeted, mm-hmm. And then maybe the tyrosine kinase inhibitors for thyroid. Mm-hmm. Okay, lung cancer. We already had Dr. Wang mentioned radiosurgery. I think you mentioned types of immunotherapy, mm-hmm. and other targets. So we got lung cancer. Breast cancer, I think you mentioned before. Any targeted therapy radiation for breast cancer?
Yeah, so in addition to the conventional way to do the traditional standard of care after lumpectomy will be whole breast radiation in a way. But then these days when people are trying to investigate a little bit more and looking at when patients have very small early stage kind of breast cancers, sometimes some patients may be candidate for partial breast irradiation, and that can be delivered in a accelerated course, either by a special device called AcuBoost, or either brachytherapy or other ways to deliver in a more accelerated partial focus kind of settings.
Okay, excellent. Kidney.
Yes.
Kidney, yeah. Dr. Lash says yes for kidney on the targeted systemic therapies. Dr. Wong, radiation?
Yes, for kidney cancers, a lot of time people, the traditional thinking was that they are resistant to radiation. But I would point out that they are resistant to conventional radiation. When they develop metastasis, actually, we have more and more evidence showing that they respond pretty well to the high-dose radiation to those focal areas. So as I mentioned, the stereotactic body radiation therapy will be good to deliver those to metastatic settings.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Colorectal cancer.
Yes.
Yes, from Dr. Lash. From Dr. Wong?
So for the metastasis, probably for the liver metastasis, as we mentioned, but otherwise maybe limited.
Yeah. Okay. Pancreas.
Yes.
Dr. Lash says yes for all of these tumors. But liver, I guess, Dr. Wong, you said liver metastasis. What about primary liver cancer, Dr. Lash?
I would say probably local therapies are the best in primary liver cancer. Primary liver cancer, hepatocellular carcinoma, is a difficult cancer to treat medically, but the therapy is targeted.
Okay, how about bladder cancer?
Yes.
Yes.
Bladder cancer, I'm not sure. I probably a more general radiation.
Not so much with the bladder. Okay, prostate cancer?
Yes.
Yes, from Dr. Lash. And what about radiation?
Yeah,
targeting?
So there's a couple of different ways to deliver radiation to the prostates. Sometimes we do the brachytherapy, both high dose rate or low dose rate, as well as people start doing the stereotactic radiation therapy. That's a focal delivery, and also the proton therapies that can be delivered focally, which I think our center fortunately has the proton therapy to deliver as well.
Okay, and we are running short of time, so let's move on to the GYN cancers, ovarian cancer. Dr. Lash.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Dr. Wong, he's shaking his head, not so much.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think what I'm hearing is that there's a tremendous amount of enthusiasm and advances in the treatment of cancer, focusing on specifically targeting the cancer cells of the various types of tumors of various stages in an effort to improve the cure rates and decrease the side effects. Is that a pretty good summary of
the term personalized medicine is a term that has gotten a lot of attention lately because of targeted therapy. And there's commercials on TV for this personalized medicine where you can have your tumor sent to a lab and they will check for, you know, all known mutations or targetable mutations that we have drugs for. And the president of ASCO, Dr. Bruce Johnson, has made precision medicine a theme of his term. And so it is a big deal. And it's in the earlier stages of development, but it definitely is believed to be the future.
Fantastic. You know, I wish we had more time to talk about this. It's a huge topic. I know we have callers who've been trying to get in, and we just unfortunately didn't have all the time that we needed, but we'll do it again. We'll bring you both back on the air, and I can't thank you enough, Dr. Lash, Dr. Wong, for bringing your expertise to this very important topic and helping educate our listeners. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or health professional. The views and opinions expressed on Health Matters may not necessarily reflect those of Red River Radio, its staff, or LSUS. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, with production assistance provided this evening by Henry Edwards, Laura McNeil, and Tim Snell. Support for this program comes from the Knoll Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Please join us next Thursday for Health Matters. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz. Thank you for joining us this evening.